potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films The Matrix Resurrections, Sing 2, The King's Man, The Tragedy of Macbeth, and Red Rocket. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring No Time to Die. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big news that happened this past week in terms of movies was the unprecedented success of Spider-Man No Way Home. It made $260 million on its opening weekend, which is a record. It's not the highest opening weekend ever, because that is held by Avengers Endgame at $357 million. But it is above Avengers Infinity War, which is 257, and it's over Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens, which was 247 million. So it's right there at number two, and that's unprecedented because we're in the middle of a pandemic. But there's a couple things you got to realize before you start declaring that cinemas are back and there is nothing that's ever going to stop a theatrical release at this point. You have to realize the stars really did align for Spider-Man No Way Home for several reasons. First of all, there was a lot of pent-up excitement for this movie. Personally, I know people who it's the first time they went to a theater in 2 years since the pandemic started. So it drew people away from the home. And yeah, you didn't have a day and date thing, so that kept it a theatrical exclusive. The other things that you had aligning for this movie is you had the fact that it was a crossover movie. It drew from other Spider-Man movies. It drew from the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You could not have had Spider-Man No Way Home if you didn't have Doctor Strange as a character, if you didn't have the elements of the Avengers playing into all of this. This was not just something that Sony did on its own. They had the full might of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the setup for the multiverse model. If you did not have that, you would not have had Spider-Man No Way Home. Now, before I talk about a potential pitfall in the future of Spider-Man, let's look at the question of, does this mean that movies are back? Theaters are back, baby! It's not going to stop us. Here's the problem, though, with Spider-Man No Way Home. As well as it did, it sucked all the air out of the room. It did 100 times better than Nightmare Alley did. And Nightmare Alley is a completely different movie. I mean, it's a darker, heavier, more adult film that is geared towards an older audience. But that movie didn't even make $3 million this weekend. That didn't even make a percentage of what West Side Story made last weekend. And West Side Story was seen as a pretty significant soft opening. In fact, Nightmare Alley made less than West Side Story did this past weekend after dropping 65%. So I would suggest that Spider-Man No Way Home is the exception rather than the new rule. And we'll see what happens this week with how well Spider-Man holds. And I imagine it's going to do well over the week, but you know, I think it's going to drop off relatively quickly, especially once the new year kicks in. And all the people that had gone and seen it to avoid spoilers have seen it. Like my family, who weren't able to go see the screening with me because it was limited to just critics, they went throughout the weekend and then into the next week. So I think once that whole week burns off, you're going to see a drop down here. You're not going to see this $100 million weekend repeating over and over and over and over and over again. So yeah, just because Spider-Man is doing well does not mean that other movies are. And I think that this plays more to the answer that, as I'd been saying for a long time, that a four-quadrant movie like this can draw people out, absolutely. But other movies, the West Side Stories, the Nightmare Alleys, the House of Gucci, those movies that appeal to an older audience are still going to play soft in theaters. Now, here's the pitfall for Spider-Man as we go forward. This could not have been done without the Marvel Cinematic Universe, without the Avengers, without movies like Endgames pushing this into a bigger sense. The fact that you had Disney Plus airing shows like WandaVision and Loki and What If all through the pandemic, that boosted the ability for Spider-Man No Way Home to actually work. But here's what my prediction is going to be. Sony's going to get greedy on this, and Sony is and they telegraph it in this movie. Though Sony's going to be like, well, we want to do our own Spider-Man thing. Oh, we don't want to give Disney any of our money. We want to keep Spider-Man for ourselves. And then they're going to try and do what they tried to do with the Amazing Spider-Man series, is create their own Spider-Man shared universe. And the heck with the Avengers. We don't want to share that. And because Disney's ready to cut them loose. Because Disney does not want to renegotiate every two or three movies, especially considering Disney plans ahead the way they do. So I think that at some point, Disney's just going to be like, fine, we'll act like Spider-Man doesn't exist, and we're going to continue to make our massive blockbusters, and you're going to try and do some sort of shared universe between Spider-Man, Venom, and Morbius. This whole multiverse, Spider-Verse thing, you can only do it so many times. It worked in Into the Spider-Verse. It worked in No Way Home. But you can't just retread. You can't just bring in Tobey Maguire and Andrew Garfield every time you want to jazz and boost the franchise. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to preview is The Lost City, which opens in theaters on March 25th.
Miss Sage, I enjoyed your book about The Lost City, and I believe you're the one who can help me find its treasure.
I have to respectfully decline.
I'm afraid I must insist.
Oh, no. Loretta Sage is missing.
I'm going to rescue her. I just want her to think of me as more than a cover model.
Let's start living dangerously.
Alan, what are you doing here?
We're here to save you. I'm certified CPR, I'm certified CrossFit. I have snacks.
Off to them!
This stars Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum. It feels a little bit like it's playing off of Romancing the Stone, because in Romancing the Stone, Joan Wilder, played by Kathleen Turner, was a romance author and ended up going on this jungle adventure that she's used to just writing at home. She's just essentially a single woman living in New York in that movie. And she ends up going on this big adventure when that was a great movie back in 1984. So The Lost City seems to be playing on that a little bit more into the absurd comedy level, because Channing Tatum isn't, you know, a rough and tumble guy in the jungle that Michael Douglas was in Romancing the Stone. He's essentially her as a fish out of water again, in the same boat. Whereas he's a model for romance covers, but he really doesn't know how to survive anything outside of the boroughs of New York City. So this looks like it might be fun. It might be cute. It's them trying to goose their careers. Sandra Bullock is playing sort of like on the edge of her age type, but that's okay. At least she's not doing something like The Unforgivable again, and we can have a little bit of fun again. The next one I want to talk about is The Northman, which opens in theaters on April 22nd.
I want to avenge your father. I want to save you, mother. I won't kill you if you live.
Why would he stow away to such a hellish place?
To find what was stolen from me.
And what is that?
The kingdom. You must choose between kindness for your kin or hate for your enemies.
Your strength breaks men's bones. I have the cunning to break their minds.
This is Robert Eggers' latest film, and he is best known for doing something like The Witch. And that movie was super polarizing because of the language, and it was spoken in this very archaic dialect of English. I mean, it was English, but it wasn't old English, but it was like middle English. It was like hundreds of years old, so it was kind of hard for people to process. And I know there are people that really, really hated The Witch. I loved The Witch. I thought it was a great movie. So I'm really curious to see what he does with The Northman, which is this story of revenge in sort of this Viking world. And, I mean, it's not spoken in, you know, Norse or anything like that. At least they're speaking their dialogue in English. But it looks like it's going to be playing around with some of the similar ideas and themes and creepiness and heaviness that we had with The Witch. So, yes, I am ready to live deliciously with this one. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Sing 2 and The King's Man.
Thank you.
to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the new movies for the week, and let's start with Sing 2. The pack of animals that hit it big with their singing competition makes their way into the entertainment capital of the world to put on a new production.
Guys, this is the entertainment capital of the world.
I'll give you 3 weeks to get this show up and running.
Take that, you nasty alien monster!
Did I do good?
Oh boy.
You have no idea what you're getting into.
Whatever podunk town they crawled out of, that's where they belong. I got you.
We cannot let that bully steal our hopes and dreams.
Okay, full disclosure here, I was not a huge fan of Sing. First of all, Sing came out at the same year that Zootopia came out. And I would call it Zootopia's Got Talent because I thought Zootopia was this clever, cute little movie. And of course, you know, it's a Disney type film where you've got animals living in a regular city. And I thought they actually told a good story. And then they came out with Sing, which basically had the same premise of this city with a bunch of zoo animals who, you know, you had gorillas and pigs and lions and bears and tigers, you know, every different type of animal. Of course, nobody ate each other, which is kind of terrifying in itself. But the movie kind of leapfrogged away from that premise and then just became American Idol for animals. And, you know, once you got past the novelty of seeing zoo animals sing popular songs, there wasn't much of a story there. There really wasn't. It was the gorilla was trying to break away from his, you know, his tracksuit mafia group that he was in. And I just never felt it had much of a story. It was more a jukebox musical. It was like watching an episode of Glee with animals instead of marginal human beings in the show Glee. But it did extremely well. It made hundreds of millions of dollars. It was a big hit on that Christmas. It was sort of like The Greatest Showman, where it got buried under all these other movies and releases, but it still did extremely well. And you know, I know people like musicals and people like singing competitions. I can't stand American Idol. I have no interest in watching something like America's Got Talent or Britain's Got Talent or Uzbekistan's Got Talent. I don't care, but I do understand that there are people who love that kind of garbage. So in Sing 2, they take the show on the road and they want to go. Basically, it's the animal version of Las Vegas. It's casinos and big hotels. And they went from being the big fish in a small pond to being a small fish in a big pond. And they're trying to put this big, huge show on. But I mean, it like the premise, it really starts to crumble as they're doing this. I mean, and this isn't sort of like the singing competition, like something like when they did Eurovision Song Contest or whatever that was with Rachel McAdams and Will Ferrell last year. That's something I could see myself watching Eurovision just for the insane spectacle of it. But this isn't even the insane spectacle of Eurovision. It's still the American Idol kid makes or animal makes it big. So it has this weird message of how bitter and painful and awful the music industry can be, which is absolutely true. But it still has that, oh, follow your dreams. Everything's important. If you just believe in yourself enough, you're going to win. And that story just doesn't quite mesh with the actual reality of the people making this movie. So I think it's just a, and then it has this whole subplot where they're trying to bring back this, I think it's a lion played by Bono, which is a little bit too close to home, I guess, where he's trying to come back and do a comeback and help them out with their show. And I don't know. It's such a stretch. Already the premise was thin. Animal singing American Idol type stuff. And now they tried to enrich the characters, but they don't because the characters are these big cliches that really are more realistic in the world that they exist in making the movie. So I don't know. If you like animal singing songs, great. Watch this movie. You're going to love it. And I have a feeling it's going to have a certain level of popularity. Although I think they kind of like the big burst of people going to theaters may have been kind of already overplayed. I mean, they may have already hit that stride with Spider-Man and you're going to dwindle in the audiences because again, this is going to be on VOD in a month. So I don't know. I'm going to say Sing 2 kind of sucks, but I guess other people are going to like it.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The King's Man. This prequel to the Kingsman movies show how the elite secret service was created during World War I.
We are the first independent intelligence agency. Preserving peace
and protecting life.
Welcome to the club.
While governments wait for orders, our people take action. Our enemies think we are gentlemen. But reputation is what people think of you.
This is one of those famous pandemic movies that got delayed. I mean, almost like James Bond, where it I think it was supposed to come out 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, something like that. I think it was supposed to come out early 2019, and it ended up getting pushed during the acquisition of Fox by Disney, and it got pushed into the pandemic era, and then it just sort of disappeared for a while, and finally Disney's like, well, we got to release it at some point, get it off the balance sheets. Oh, yeah, 6 days before the end of the year, let's do that. So The Kingsman is a prequel to the Kingsman movie. So you don't have all the people like Colin Firth, all the characters you knew and love from the original movies, not in because it's a prequel that takes place 100 years ago. And that's fine. That stuff can work. But this movie, it's weirdly uneven. There are times where it is deadly serious. I mean, like emotionally devastating World War I reality. And that can be, you know, these heavy scenes. And then other times it's kind of whimsical and weird, although it doesn't do the whimsical and weird as often. But like one of the bad guys in this is Rasputin, who was a weird guy anyways. If you know anything about history and about Rasputin, he was strange. So scenes with him, they start out as strange and then they dip into uncomfortable and into then, I guess it was meant to be funny, but you got to have a real sick sense of humor to fully appreciate it. And I guess I do. The tone is all over the place. Now, I know there's some people who just are railing on this movie. Like I talked to somebody who saw it. I was on a junket at the beginning of December and I was talking to somebody who had already seen it and they were really lambasting it. And then I watched it and I'm like, yeah, there's the tone is uneven all over the place. And it's kind of trying to do two or three things that oftentimes are in conflict with each other. And so it's not a fully formed movie, but I still think it doesn't have great focus and it's a real mixed bag. It's kind of all over the place. It doesn't know what it wants to be. It's basically me when I was like 20 years old, you know, an emotional wreck, up and down, all over the place, didn't know what I wanted to do and finding myself in an ill-fitting suit. You know, that's kind of what this movie is. It has some moments that are really fun, I gotta say. And there's some moments that are weirdly hilarious in a very uncomfortable way, but it doesn't reach the level of silliness that the first movies are. So I think if you watch this, you can think it's just too heavy or dour. So I have a more favorable view of The Kingsman, partly because I didn't think the first two movies were untouchable. I mean, people love that first movie, and I'm like, it has some real problems to it. It also has some uncomfortable misogynistic at times. And there's a level of violence in the movie that I think some people loved. But even though it was directed at a certain type of person, it was still an unpleasant thing that was going on. And I think that carried over into the sequel. So this one I thought was okay. I didn't hate it. And I guess that's enough to put it on a cover box. So I'm going to say The Kingsman kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Matrix Resurrections and Red Rocket. Welcome back to Feck Eyes at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about the one that's going to be the big one this weekend. It's probably Spider-Man is going to be the big one, but to me, it's the bigger movie, and that is The Matrix Resurrections. A young hacker teams with AI units to release Neo again after he has been caged in a new emulation of The Matrix.
If you want the truth, Neo, you're going to have to follow me.
The only thing that matters to you is still here. I know it's why you're still fighting and why you will never give up.
You don't know me.
No?
After all these years, to be going back to where it all started. Back to the Matrix.
I was talking to somebody earlier this week and I came to the realization that there are really kind of two types of Matrix fans. there are those that saw the first movie and loved it and enjoyed it. And that was kind of everybody. A lot of people saw it. It was unique and different and groundbreaking, and people enjoyed it on all different levels. Everyone from just who liked a big old action movie to somebody who likes the, you know, the darker, more sociopolitical commentary that's woven in there and the deep dive into reality and understanding and religion and that sort of thing. When the Wachowskis did the sequels, they put in a lot more of that woven social commentary, and it really kind of deep dives, especially the second one, into the nature of reality and choice. And there's a lot of stuff buried in there, but then there's also the drudgery of the real world and the juxtaposition of the reality of the world and the pain that we feel on that, and the hyper-real virtual world, which can be oppressive but still offers a lot of freedom in that oppression. And that gets even more extreme in The Matrix Revolutions, which was the third movie, which famously did not do very well at all. So the people who just wanted the big action movie, who liked it as just a run-of-the-mill sci-fi movie, those people get disappointed with the sequels. And this is not me marginalizing them. This is not me making some sort of, well, you're not smart enough to understand it. It's just where your level of fandom is. So for me, I was more into the concepts behind The Matrix and the going down the rabbit hole. And I wanted to go farther down the rabbit hole. And when the Wachowskis took you farther down the rabbit hole in the second and third movie, I was in all the way. And I love the second movie. I think the second movie is amazing. Yeah, there's goofy things. And yeah, the rave scene is kind of stupid. And then when they get to the third movie, it does spend a lot of time outside of the Matrix. And it's the coolest part is when they're in the Matrix. But I still love that contemplation of when does reality or even consciousness begin? And what does it mean? And where are the levels of freedom and having freedom within the constraints of a prison? I mean, that's I found fascinating. Those people who like that, I think, are going to appreciate this movie the most. I think it can be appreciated on both levels, because on one level, it is a big, awesome action movie. And in fact, you only have one Wachowski directing it. This time you got Lana Wachowski. And so she's kind of got it on her own, and she swings for the fences. And for the most part, I think she hits at least into the stands, or at least far into the outfield for this. I think she does a great job with this movie, delivering the high-end epic action movie that people are expecting from the original Matrix. But there's 20 some years of cinema that have passed along since then. And so this isn't just about computer games and kung fu action sequences, which they were obviously inspired by a lot in that first movie. They were inspired by comic books. They were inspired by anime. They were inspired by martial arts movies. This version of the Matrix, you see the 20 some years of cinema between them. And so Lana Wachowski dips into things like zombie movies, and in particular Korean zombie movies. Like, there's a huge homage to Train to Busan. And then there's pushing the envelope of what a zombie movie could be. So she plays around with some really neat stuff. One of the genius parts about The Matrix is it allows the movie to be self-aware and deconstruct exactly what it's building at the same time. And so this movie deconstructs action movies, it deconstructs science fiction, it deconstructs video games, and it deconstructs carrying on a franchise. It's very self-aware. They make jokes even inside comments about having to do a sequel, not wanting to do it, and bringing in the original people because they're going to make it anyways. So there's a lot of sociopolitical commentary just woven in and buried in there. Sometimes it's not very buried very deep. But if anything has taught me over the last several years, you don't have to bury stuff deep for the people who don't agree with it to just completely miss it. But science fiction and horror are always political, almost always political, unless there's something stupid like a Michael Bay movie. But yeah, so The Matrix Resurrection has all that stuff woven in there, and it's there to be deconstructed. And I think Lana Wachowski does a fantastic job balancing this and telling a story without just aping the original. I mean, there's a lot of references and there's a lot of similarities to the original Matrix from 1999, but this is very different. And it's not just The Matrix reskinned, it's The Matrix going down a different rabbit hole that's adjacent to the one that we went down before. So I'm a huge fan of The Matrix as a series and as a concept, and I'm a huge fan of the Wachowskis' work. I mean, even stuff that people don't like Cloud Atlas or you know, Jupiter Ascending. I think those movies have a lot of merit. And this one, I think, is fantastic. I loved it. So I'm going to say The Matrix Resurrections totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk really quickly about Red Rocket. A former adult film star returns home to Texas to start his life over again, but falls for a girl working at a local donut shop.
You said you're never going to step a foot in Texas again.
I know, this is unexpected.
I moved back in with my wife last week.
I just need a place to crash for a couple of days. What's the big deal?
You should have called.
All right, look, I'm going to be straight with you. I'm an adult film actor.
Excuse me?
So why are you back, Mr. Hollywood?
You're Mikey. Welcome back, dude.
With my skill and ability, there's no denying what I can do. The universe is on my side, bro.
Before long, it'll be like we're still married.
We are still married.
This has been out for a while, for several weeks in limited release, and it's finally sort of making its way through the country. So I figure now is a good time to talk about it because you should have opportunity to see it if you want to. And if not, it's going to show up on VOD very, very soon. This is directed by Sean Baker, who did movies like Tangerine and The Florida Project. He's known for doing very independent-minded, gritty, the lives of lower class or trashy people, depending on how you view people within the movie. I mean, there's definitely people in these movies that are sympathetic lower class, and then there's people who are absolute garbage and trash, and they all live in the same neighborhood. But this movie is about this guy played by Simon Rex, who Simon Rex is about my age. I turned 50 this year, so he's pushing 50. And it's funny, this guy's been around for decades. He was in one of the early Scary Movie 3 or something like that. And he's shown up and stuff here and there, but this is sort of his shining moment to do an acting performance. So he plays this guy who's trying to start his life over, but he's hit the skids in many different ways. And it's him trying to build his life back up. But it's a character study in failure. It's a character study of a person who does not know how to grow up. And I know one of the things that a lot of people get bothered by is the age difference between him and the girl at the donut shop. This is not illegal. I mean, it's smarmy and creepy and, you know, inappropriate, but it's not an illegal thing. And I know that that bothered a lot of people, but I'm like, no, that's kind of the point of this story. He's a guy who keeps falling into the same traps. And even though he had a career where he probably made a lot of money, but he still has to come home and live with his ex-wife. So it's him just going into a repetition, and in this relationship he starts is the probably you can just tell by the way it's set up is that it's probably very similar to the relationship he had with his wife. And his wife's in her early 40s, I think, in this movie, or late 30s. And his wife would have been probably close to 20 when they got together, and she was probably a lot better looking, and she wasn't on as much drugs, and she didn't have as many years on the warranty. And he's just repeating the same thing. And it's this fantasy he can't escape from because he hasn't grown up. And that's the point of the movie. It's not meant to be, oh, this isn't this cool. Wouldn't be neat to have this relationship. It's you looking and saying, this guy's pathetic and here's why. And that's why I think it works. Also, he's weirdly compelling. You know, I mean, he's not a nice guy, but he's somebody you could hang out with. So, I mean, it's an independent and gritty movie. Not for everybody, but I found it kind of interesting. I was surprised at how much I liked it, given the subject matter. So I'm going to say Red Rocket kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Tragedy of Macbeth and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring No Time to Die. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about The Tragedy of Macbeth. I know you're not supposed to say the name, but I'm not an actor unless you count my act on the stage of life, and I'm not in a theater, so I think I'm safe. I mean, who knows? I mean, my world may come crumbling around me, but I don't think I can make it any worse than after they made that Cats movie and then the coronavirus hit. So, but I'm going to be talking about The Tragedy of Macbeth, which is the latest offering from Joel Coen, just one of the Coen brothers. You know, very similar to how the Wachowskis, only Lana Wachowski is directing The Matrix Resurrections. Joel Coen is not working with his brother Ethan on this one. Joel Coen directs this unique adaptation of William Shakespeare's play about the rise and fall of a Scottish king.
Thank you.
pricking of my thumbs. Something wicked this way comes.
Shakespeare is not always easy. Shakespeare is something that you have to study and dissect. And it's a tragedy. This is not the whimsical comedy that something like Much Ado About Nothing is. You can really make Much Ado About Nothing easy breezy. You can even, something like Romeo and Juliet, which is a tragedy. People have seen that and heard that. That's usually your first introduction as a kid. It plays much more smoothly to digest as an audience. Something like The Tragedy of Macbeth is a much heavier, weightier play. And it's about power and struggle and sacrifice and betrayal. And it's got a lot of negative things wrapped up in there. And it's sort of even like Hamlet even like is a little more relatable because that's more about guilt and suffering on your own and this internalized stuff. Whereas Macbeth is more about what you put out in the world and what comes back to you. And there's a lot of depth to be discovered in this, but it's Shakespeare play. So it's got Shakespearean language and it's be preserved the language. So you really have to concentrate. And you like, you watch Romeo and Juliet, you end up picking up and easing into the dialect so much easier because it's a little more familiar of a story. This one's a little bit heavier and darker and it has some supernatural elements to it. And so it's a little bit harder to digest, but that's not a knock on this movie. The movie itself is fascinating to watch. It's opening in theaters, I think, on Christmas Day. So I'm covering it a little bit early and it's doing a limited run for a couple weeks. It'll be available on Apple TV Plus, I think January 14th. So in a couple weeks, you'll be able to watch it online. It's very uniquely done. The staging of it. And that's one of the things whenever you do a Shakespeare play, it's not just about saying the lines because the lines stay the same or they should. It's about how you show it and how you put the sets together. Well, in this one, they take a somewhat theatrical approach to it. The sets and the design are sort of subreal. They are simplified. They don't look like things would normally look. Like when Roman Polanski did his version of Macbeth, he shot it as if it were taking place in medieval Scotland. This one, it sets. It feels manufactured in a very artistic way, in a very stylized way. And that I found fascinating. It's also in black and white, which seems to be a little bit of a kitschy thing right now. There's a handful of movies right now, you know, stuff like Come On, Come On and Belfast. Movies that are produced and distributed in black and white, but they shoot it in the Academy frame, which is sort of like the TV frame, the almost square frame. But there's a specific reason, I'm not actually sure why, but there's a very specific reason why Joel Cohen shot it in the Academy frame, the square frame. And the acting, I mean, Denzel Washington playing Macbeth and Frances McDormand playing Lady Macbeth. Denzel Washington's not Scottish. And both he and Frances McDormand are way above the age that their characters are, but that's okay. It's an interpretation of a play. I mean, it's already hyper-real anyways because of the language. They do some really neat stuff there. In particular, the witches, which are Bubble Bubble, Toil and Trouble. They're all played by one actress, Catherine Hunter, and she treats them as three versions of herself. And she's almost this contortionist who comes in and it's creepy and the delivery. I mean, it's one of the most innovative ways of performing the witches I've ever seen. She should be up for every award that there is because she's amazing in the movie, even more than, I mean, Denzel is Denzel playing his version of Macbeth and Frances McDormand is playing the Frances McDormand version of Lady Macbeth. Again, it takes a lot to digest. And this is one where, you know, it might benefit from an online release because you can pause it and you can think about it. You don't have to watch the whole thing in one fell swoop because it's a lot to get through, and especially if you're not terribly familiar with the Macbeth story and the Macbeth play. So I'm going to have to say The Tragedy of Macbeth totally rocks. It's worth checking out.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today I'm going to look at No Time to Die, which just came out on DVD, Blu-ray, and 4K. Daniel Craig finishes up his tenure as James Bond in this thriller about a genocidal madman who has developed a powerful new weapon.
We used to be able to get into a room with the enemy. Now they're just floating in the ether.
When her secret finds its way out, it'll be the death of you.
Oh my God. Target enough people.
Remember, people become the weapon. Who is he?
James, you don't know what this is.
You know, going back and revisiting this movie, I have mixed feelings about it. I have mixed feelings about the whole run of Daniel Craig. I thought he started off very, very strong. I loved Casino Royale, and I thought Quantum of Solace was actually pretty good. I know some people don't like that one. Skyfall was a little overrated. I didn't think Spectre was great. And this movie, part of it is they and I said this when I reviewed it earlier, they're putting way too much importance on the development of James Bond as a character, and you don't want to develop his character. He's an archetype. There's a lot of darkness and unpleasantness that you don't want deconstructed. You don't want him to get better because then he wouldn't be James Bond, but you don't want to shine a light on all the darkness either, because it's then you realize how unpleasant the inside of the character really is. And the movie itself, it's bloated. It's long. It's almost 3 hours long, and that's because it's kind of two different movies. It's a traditional James Bond movie with a bad guy, but then it's all him trying to reconcile his own emotions and stuff. I hope they don't overly develop the Bond character too much in the next iteration of it, because I'd like to just go back to the fun run-and-gun action movie where you have an archetypal character. And fine, let him evolve. Don't make him such a womanizer. Don't have him smacking somebody on the butt and saying, oh, you need to go now because we're doing man talk, which actually happens in Goldfinger. So there's a lot packed into this movie, and it's not that it conflicts with itself. It's just you keep having to sort of shift gears on what the movie is. It's still satisfying to a degree. It's completely predictable because we all know what's happening in this movie. But I think sometimes they squander the villain, because the villain just at a certain point he checks out and he's not in there for like an hour. But the best stuff's kind of in the middle, where Bond is mixing it up, and, you know, got Ana de Armas that's coming in as a new agent, and she's a lot of fun. And just because she adds some levity to the heaviness that Daniel Craig's bringing to the character. And so there's elements to the movie that I really, really enjoy. What's interesting is I looked at the Blu-ray, and the since it's an almost 3 hour movie, the most of what's on the first disc is the movie. The second disc is a bonus disc. And I'm like, oh my gosh, how many hours of footage and how many hours of special features are going to be? There's only about 30 or 40 minutes of special features on that bonus disc. And I think that's just because it didn't fit on the feature disc, but they really didn't fill it up. They didn't pack it to the rim with special features. Maybe they're going to be doing another version of it, or they're going to do like a Daniel Craig Essentials Bond set or something like that. But I was kind of disappointed. The special features were interesting, although there's somebody who does have to say the stupid cliche of, well, I wanted to make the locations characters in the movie themselves. If that's not the most cliche thing to quit saying that, please quit saying that. If you are a production designer or a location manager, do not say that, because that makes you sound stupid. The problem is, when I watch the special features, I do realize that there's certain things that are lacking in this movie. It lacks the definitive James Bond sequence. You know, there's some movies that you remember, you know, like You Only Live Twice has the massive hollowed out volcano. Octopussy, which has this great sequence in India. You look at stuff like the Daniel Craig ones in Casino Royale. You have the car flip, the amazing stunt with a car flip. In Skyfall, you have the train sequence. I just didn't feel like there was any really memorable action sequence, that it just kind of seemed to be going through the motions because they were really just trying to push this story that was overwritten. So I'm still mixed in my thoughts on No Time to Die, so I'm going to have to say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Also available this week on DVD and Blu-ray, we've got The Many Saints of Newark and Demon Slayer, the movie. And then from The Vault, we've got The Vampire Lovers on Blu-ray. And that's it. Next week when I come back, I'm going to be talking about the best and the worst of 2021. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.